His first visit in London was the HMV Record Center on Oxford Street. Brian had decided to make the tapes into records, which were more convenient for people to listen to. The technician making the disc said he really liked the sound of the band and told a publisher who had an office upstairs. His name was Sid Coleman, and he too thought the tapes were very exciting. He said that he'd speak to a friend of his who was A&R director at Parlophone Records, a man named George Martin, who he felt would be very interested in hearing them. The next day, Brian met George Martin.
He was a typical sort of northern young entrepreneur, if you know what I mean. He was well-spoken and well-mannered and so on, and obviously had a burning faith in these boys. And he was obviously determined that they were going to be successful, no matter what I did with them. Mm-hmm. He just gave you that impression, and he was undoubtedly a tremendous influence in making them a hit.
As the discs were played, Brian sat with a face like stone, as if his very life was at stake. George commented that he knew very little about beat groups, but said that there was something good going on.
I wasn't terribly knocked out by it. In fact, I thought it was not very good. But there was some undefinable quality of rawness, of kind of, I suppose, something that was I hadn't heard before that I thought might be useful to investigate. And anyway, I was looking for a new act, to be honest, so that I was ready for something. And when I suggested that Brian brought them down for a recording test. Now, that wasn't a great decision, quite honestly, because I couldn't lose by it. It meant these poor fellows had to travel down from Liverpool, spend an afternoon with me in the studio, which I was quite prepared to do, to find out how they ticked.
Brian and George Martin arranged a demo session at EMI in London for June 6th, and Brian returned to Liverpool to be greeted at Lime Street Station by the four of them. They celebrated at the National Milk Bar, where they got drunk with Power, Coca-Cola, and four packets of biscuits. They planned a wild future of hit records and world tours and ticker tape parades in every foreign capital. Unbelievably, it all came true. When George Martin met the Beatles, he liked them immediately. The most impressive thing was their engaging personalities.
When we did meet on that occasion, well, it was just love at first sight. I thought they were super. It wasn't a question of what they could do, because they hadn't written anything that was great at that time. But they had great personalities, they had a great way with them, and they charmed themselves to me a great deal. They knew I was a guy who made all the Peter Sellers records, and they were great fans. John and George and Paul, Pete Best, who was also part of the group, was very much the background boy. He didn't say much at all, he just looked moody and sullen in the corner. And George, I suppose, was probably the most vociferous of the lot. But they were all very good.
Engineer on the session, Norman Smith, explains.
After the sound recording test, was that we took them up into the control room, George Martin and I, and we then spoke to them about the what was expected. After this laying down the law, he said to them, well, you've sat there very patiently listening to us. Is there anything at all that you want to say to us? And there was a silence. And it was George Harrison, strangely enough, that broke this silence that went on for some little time after the, you know, flashing glances to one another. And just simply said, yeah, to George Martin, addressing himself to George Martin. Yeah, he says, I don't like your tie.
When the Beatles and Brian left the Abbey Road studios at EMI, there was still no contract, but they were full of hope. They flew again to Hamburg and a further performance on the Reeperbahn, and Brian went back to his record store in Liverpool. In July, George Martin had made up his mind to sign up the Beatles. Brian sent cables to all of the boys in Germany. EMI contract signed, sealed. Tremendous importance to all of us. Wonderful. In August, Pete Best is asked to leave the Beatles by Brian Epstein. The Beatles, especially George and Paul, were not happy with his drumming. They thought him a loner and too conventional to be a Beatle. To top things off, George Martin had told Brian at the end of their audition test in London that Pete wasn't good enough.
What happened was that after the first sessions that I tried out with them in the middle of 1962, I decided that Pete wasn't a very good drummer and wasn't going to make my life very easy in making good records. So I went to Brian and I said, look, I appreciate the problem I'm going to give you, but there's no reason why, to the public, Pete Best shouldn't be part of the group, but as far as records are concerned, he's out. I can get a very good drummer in, and that's the way we're going to make records. Well, I didn't realize, I learned later,
that the boys had been thinking of getting rid of him anyway. And I guess my decision kind of sealed it.
The man who took over on the drums was their old friend from Liverpool and Hamburg, Richard Starkey. Stage name, Ringo Starr. With gold cowboy boots, a gray streak in his hair, and a desperado's thin mustache and beard, Ringo was playing at a Butlins holiday camp when the call came.
Brian Epstein phoned me up and said, would you like to join the Beatles, you know? He said, he phoned me up on a Tuesday and said, would you join the Beatles? I said, yeah. He said, well, can you get home tonight? And I said, I can't leave the other group just like that, you know. Must give a bit of notice, so I said, I'll be there Saturday.
Savage fans of Pete's hounded and yelled for Pete during Ringo's first performances with the Beatles. The change in personnel, however, hardly changed their status as Mersey's favorite beat group. On August 23, 1962, John married his girlfriend, Cynthia Powell, at a quiet ceremony in a Liverpool registry office. The marriage was kept from their fans, even Ringo. At long last, on September 11th, George Martin brought the Beatles down to London's Abbey Road Studios to make their first record. From their material, George Martin picked Love Me Do and P.S. I Love You.
I was convinced I had a hit group on my hands, if only I could get the right songs. And couldn't find anything better, so I reluctantly agreed to release Love Me Do as a first one.
The song Love Me Do was written mostly by Paul. Peggy Lee had just released a record called P.S. I Love You, so to avoid confusion, Love Me Do would be the better A-side. George Martin had not expected Ringo, and so had another studio drummer, Andy White, ready to play the session. Engineer on the session, Norman Smith, explains.
He was a terribly shy and reticent type of chap. It might have been because of that that maybe he didn't, you know, feel that he could do the sort of drumming that was required, or he wasn't too confident about it anyway. So we brought in a session drummer for Love Me Do.
After about 17 takes, they had it. They did versions with and without Ringo. They eventually used Ringo's drumming on the single in Britain and Canada, but the Andy White version with Ringo playing tambourine was issued on their first album and later around the world.